Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I represent the appellants today. This is a claim that arises under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment against defendants who were prosecutors and the county that directed and supervised them because of the deliberate abandonment of the prosecution of the assailant of my client, HP, as she's referred to in court papers, for the specific reason that she belonged to a disfavored class of crime victims, specifically minors who were the victims of an incestuous sexual assault as opposed to...
Mr. Lesher, I'm sorry to interrupt you right away, but I feel compelled to ask you this question. I mean, aren't the cases against you the idea that somebody has the right under the Equal Protection Clause to have the government charge someone else? And there's so many cases, and they all are against you, aren't they? I mean...
Well, there are cases that say, and we don't dispute, that you don't have a right to compel any aspect of law enforcement to protect you. You don't have a right to require that police make an arrest. You don't have a right to require that prosecutors prosecute. And if they don't, you don't have a right to sue them because they didn't. That's clear. That's acknowledged. But it's a horse of a different color what you allege is that you are a victim of discriminatory handling of your criminal complaint by a law enforcement official. That's our allegation in this case. That's what HP alleges. And you don't have to take my word for that distinction. It's made in the case law. Let's take a look at one of the most recent cases of this nature, the State of Macias versus Ida, which was a Ninth Circuit case in the year 2000. That case very specifically says both things. It says you do not have a right to sue law enforcement officials because they failed to law enforce and protect you. But you do have a right, as the plaintiff in that case did, to argue that you were the victim of discriminatory treatment against a certain class of crime victims to which the plaintiff belonged. That's why the Ninth Circuit upheld the claim in that case.
Well, what's the protected class that these plaintiffs belong to?
I'm sorry, which plaintiffs?
What is the protected class that these plaintiffs belong to?
In this case?
Of equal protection, yes.
In terms of equal protection law, the case law doesn't require that the plaintiffs actually belong to a protected class as long as there is intentional and invidious discrimination. You see that, for example, in the Myers case, Myers versus County of Orange, Second Circuit appellate case from 1998, where he alleged a violation of equal protection based on specifically the conduct of prosecutors and the way they handled his complaint against police. Now, he alleged the equal protection violation based on the fact that the merits of his case required expedited treatment. He didn't claim he was a member of a protected class. He wasn't. Nevertheless, the Second Circuit upheld that claim and said he did have standing to pursue it. You don't actually have to belong to a protected class to be a victim of invidious discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. Now, my client alleges that she's a victim of discriminatory handling because she was an incest victim. But the case law involves all kinds of different classes of people who have made this argument. And the cases go back 25 years, all the way back to Thurman versus City of Torrington, which was a Connecticut District Court case in 1984, and it's been repeatedly upheld in appellate decisions of the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, as well as others, that have repeatedly affirmed that there is a right of crime victims to sue law enforcement officials when, because of their membership in a disfavored class, they didn't get the same kind of justice that someone else would have received. That underlies the basis of our claim here. And by the way, I just want to quote one line from the Thurman versus Torrington case because it is the granddaddy of all these cases. It's the holding that gets repeated, reaffirmed, and incorporated in all the holdings since. And the language there is very clear. I'm going to quote it. It is well settled that the Equal Protection Clause is applicable to to discriminatory governmental action in administration and enforcement of the law. With that holding, the court held the crime victim did have standing to sue. In that case, it was police officers and other law enforcement officials because they weren't treating complaints of domestic abuse against wives and against children by abusive fathers the same way they treated other claims. Now, notice that language doesn't say all law enforcement officials except prosecutors. It doesn't say only some law enforcement officials. It says discriminatory governmental action in administration and enforcement of the law. That's the nature of our claim. HP is a crime victim. She alleges discrimination in administration and enforcement of the law by these state actors who happen to be prosecutors. And by the way, when the court said that's well settled, how was it well settled? Well, in part, it was well settled because of a decision of this court. Britton v. Rogers, which was handed down in 1980, used almost the identical language. Here it is. The Equal Protection Clause is applicable not only to discriminatory legislative action, but also to discriminatory governmental action in the administration and enforcement of the law. Exactly the language that Thurman used to affirm a right of crime victims to proceed against law enforcement officials. Now, that's one line of case law that we have supporting this claim. There's another, and that is a series of cases that specifically uphold the right of plaintiffs to sue prosecutors when they allege a pattern of selective prosecution that violated equal protection. Precedents of those exist in God's plenty, and there are quite a few from this circuit. U.S. v. Leathers, U.S. v. Frazier, we cited them in our brief. And I do want to stress for a moment the Myers case, Myers versus County of Orange, because the way this was presented in the prosecutor's brief, if I may say so, was rather misleading, and it tends to obscure the point that that case makes. Myers versus County of Orange involved a plaintiff who was a criminal defendant, but his equal protection claim did not arise out of being a criminal defendant. He didn't allege that he was a victim of discriminatory prosecution. That's the point I want to stress. He made a cross complaint against police, alleging that he was a victim of police misconduct. Under the rules of a jurisdiction, that complaint had to be handled by members of a district attorney's office. They, following an official policy of the county, took those complaints only on the basis of which was filed first. He said, no, my complaint, because of its merits, needs expedited treatment, and this kind of treatment violates my right to equal protection. Second Circuit Court of Appeals in 1998 said, you're right, you do have standing, you can proceed. Note, he's proceeding specifically on the basis of a prosecutorial policy, just as we are. He went after the county as well as the prosecutors, just as we are. And he was able to bring that claim, and his standing was affirmed not because he was a criminal defendant, not because he was a victim of discriminatory prosecution against him, but because of the way they handled his claim against somebody else. Those are two lines of case authority that really intersect neatly in exactly the fact pattern we have in this case. We've got a crime victim asserting an equal protection claim against law enforcement officials who are prosecutors because we allege a pattern of discriminatory enforcement. I'm sorry, were you going to ask? Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. Now, that's the authority that supports it. And by the way, that's not disputed by the defendants in this case. And while I'm on the point of what's not disputed, I want to add one more thing. The one doctrine that could conceivably distinguish prosecutors from other law enforcement officials who might be defendants in such a case, which is the doctrine of prosecutorial immunity, even according to the defendants in this case, cannot justify the dismissal of the plaintiff's claims. The defendants have admitted in their briefs that prosecutorial immunity will not shield the county. It follows, therefore, that it also won't shield the prosecutors in their official capacities, because the case law says those are effectively identical. And the prosecutors concede that prosecutorial immunity will not protect them from the equitable claims that we raise in this case. So it's agreed on all hands, according to these lines of authority, which are not challenged, and the doctrine of prosecutorial immunity, the extent of which at this point at least is not disputed, that HP's claims are valid, that she has standing to pursue them. What has happened in this case is that the state has raised a series of arguments, which I have to characterize as red herrings, to try to deflect the court's attention from what the real authority is and suggest other things that are happening. And Judge Murphy already pointed out one of them, and that is the state is attempting to argue that what HP is trying to do here in alleging discriminatory handling by prosecutors can't be done because there's no right to enforce a specific prosecution in a specific case. Well, we don't dispute that. We don't argue that there is. And when the prosecutors say that that's what HP is trying to do, the simple answer to that is no, she's not. Our complaint is very clear. What she's alleging is not the failure to prosecute, per se. What she's alleging is a discriminatory policy that resulted in a failure of prosecution in this case. And again, that distinction is borne out in the state of Macias versus Ida, and prosecutors don't deny the validity of that case. So that excuse me, that line of argument just doesn't hold water. The cases they cite, Linda R.S., Sattler, and so on, these were all cases in which the holdings do not address an equal protection issue because there was no equal protection issue to address. What they said is you can't bring an action against prosecutors requiring them to prosecute. No matter how badly you may feel, you had a right to prosecution. Granted. But those cases do not say you don't have a right to sue for discriminatory handling by prosecutors or any other law enforcement officials when they discriminated against you because of your membership in a disfavored class. On the contrary, plenty of authority says you can't. Second approach the state takes is to say, okay, let's set aside for a moment, well, they didn't say this, but evidently the prosecutors ignore the authority that says crime victims can sue law enforcement officials generally. They just look at the cases that say you can sue prosecutors. Well, there are plenty of those cases. Say the prosecutors, though, you can only bring those claims because you were yourself a target of discriminatory prosecution. It's not so. It's not so, first of all, because none of those cases actually limit standing and its holding in such a fashion. It's not so because if it were true, then how did the crime victims in cases like Macias and Navarro v. Block and Myers versus County of Orange and Thurman versus City of Torrington, how did they have standing? They weren't targets of discriminatory law enforcement procedures themselves. They weren't discriminated against. They weren't prosecuted at all. They were crime victims. They weren't arrested. They weren't charged. So how did they have standing if the prosecutor's argument is valid? And the third reason we know it's not true is the Myers case. Because although it's true Myers was a criminal defendant, his claim clearly didn't arise out of being a criminal defendant. It didn't arise out of a claim of discriminatory prosecution of which he was not a target. So that fails. And before I leave that argument, I just have to mention, I think it's ironic that we have prosecutors here arguing before this court that equal protection rights don't exist on behalf of innocent victims of crime on whose behalf they prosecute, but do exist in the criminal defendants they go after to try to convict and put in prison. I would accept that, ironic as it is, if there was some authority that supported it. But there isn't. The third argument they make, which frankly I find even more jaw-dropping than that, is to say, well, it's true, you can sue law enforcement officials for a violation of your equal protection rights, but prosecutors aren't law enforcement officials. Honestly, there are cases that say they are, but until this argument was made in these briefs, I don't think anybody ever contended that seriously, and I don't think anyone can. If prosecutors aren't law enforcement officials, I don't know what they are, and I'd be curious to see what the prosecutor's counsel has to say. Likewise, if there can be such a thing as law enforcement without the step of prosecution, which completes the process, again, I don't know how it works. And if there's a right of equal protection in law enforcement that doesn't include equal protection in prosecution, I don't see what the right means. I see I've run through my main time, and with your permission, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
One question. Under your theory, who does not have standing?
We're only asserting standing on behalf of the crime victim who is the target of discriminatory policy on
why shouldn't anyone? Why shouldn't you have standing? Aren't you interested in equal protection of the law?
We all are, but that's exactly the point. With respect to what the law should be, the theory is all of us stand in equal relation to law enforcement. None of us has one right to law enforcement that's greater than anybody else's right. And that's the way it has to be in a society of laws like ours. But when there is discrimination on the part of law enforcement against a particular class, that's exactly the assumption that breaks down. And what happens then is that the members of that disfavored class, when they're injured by that discrimination, they have standing to redress that evil, the evil precisely of discrimination. I don't have the right to go to court and say, you know, you shouldn't be doing that to other people. But they have a right to claim that they were victims of discrimination that directly affected them. With your permission, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you.
Ms. Freno, is that pronounced?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Lori Freno, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees Stephen Tabor and Daniel Hsu. Your Honors, no court has ever held that a crime victim has Article III standing to pursue a lawsuit in federal court trying to seek to have a prosecutor prosecute a case. To the contrary, the United States Supreme Court held in the case of Lind R.S. versus Richard D. that crime victims do not have that standing. And that case, Linda R.S., is dispositive of the case before us. In Linda R.S., like in the present case, the crime victim did allege an equal protection violation, did allege equal protection, and she sought to force a criminal prosecution. Specifically, there was a state statute that provided parents who do not support their children are criminally liable. And the way the prosecutor was interpreting that statute was to apply it only to legitimate children and not illegitimate children. The plaintiffs in the Linda R.S. case were the mother of an illegitimate child, the child, and then they allege they're bringing the action on behalf of all similarly situated. In that context, the Supreme, which is directly analogous to ours, the Supreme Court said no standing. A crime victim does not have standing. And it is because for someone to have standing to proceed in federal court, they must have a direct or threatened injury that results from the action of the challenged action. And in the Linda R.S. case, the injury, any injury the child suffered, the court recognized, was not caused by the prosecutor not criminally prosecuting the father, but rather was caused by the father not paying the child support. And the court said, in order for there to be standing, there must be this direct relationship between the alleged injury and the challenged action. And comparing that to the present case, it's absolutely on point analogous. Any injury suffered by HP was not caused by the prosecutor not bringing this prosecution. Rather, it was caused by her alleged assailant. And the way the criminal justice system is set up, she does not have recourse to go to the court, to the criminal courts for this, but she can go to civil court to get redress from the person who actually injured her. The prosecutor did not injure her. Her alleged assailant did. And in fact, she did go in this case to civil court and did receive an award against her alleged assailant. The Supreme Court also in the Linda R.S. case, recognized that it has consistently held that a private citizen does not have standing to contest prosecutorial policies. If they are not either prosecuted or threatened with prosecution, and that's a very important point, prosecuted or threatened with prosecution, because that distinguishes so many of these cases cited by the appellants. Because if you are prosecuted or threatened, you do have an injury that is flowing directly from, or an alleged injury, that is flowing directly from the conduct of the prosecutor. The same is true in the police protection cases. If someone calls the police and the police won't show up for some discriminatory reason, such as in the state of Macias, because the woman who called was a Latina or she was a female, or because, like in Thurman versus City of Torrington, because the police don't want to deal with certain types of claims among family members, even though they would deal with the same ones elsewhere. That person who called the police has a direct, immediate, palpable, concrete injury that resulted from the police, if they're injured or threatened with injury, from the police not showing up, from the police not providing equal protection. Definitely, definitely, the police have the obligation to provide equal protection. And to say, to take broad general law that prosecutors, and say prosecutors are law enforcement officials, so all these cases that apply to the police apply to the prosecutors. First of all, that flies in the face of Linda R.S. It would be contrary to binding Supreme Court precedent. But also, appellants have not cited to one case in which a prosecutor was found to be a, quote, law enforcement officer for purposes of equal protection. And perhaps, as the court recognized in Linda R.S., criminal prosecutions enjoy a special status. Yet criminal prosecutions have a special status in our system. Likewise, criminal prosecutors would have a special status. It's important to remember that when a prosecutor prosecutes a case, they are not doing it on behalf of the victim. They're doing it on behalf of society. That's the way the structure is set up. So the individual person who was offended against, the crime victim, they don't have standing anymore to force a prosecution than does someone else in society who just might be interested in seeing that justice be done. Regarding Myers, I just would like to point out on that one that they were not seeking in that case to enjoin a criminal prosecution. A prosecutor was named as a defendant in the first instance, but certainly there would have been standing because Mr. Myers was charged with a crime. The prosecutor was then dismissed from the case, and the actual holding ran against only the police. The police, county, and city, they were enforcing a policy that was considered to violate equal protection. And it's also very telling in Myers that the court recognized city and county police, you refused to take that charge from that man, from Myers. Now the evidence is stale. If you would have taken that charge, you could have, the information, if you would have taken the evidence, you then could have submitted it to the prosecutor, and the prosecutor would have been allowed to exercise his discretion. But the way it stands, the county and city did not give the prosecutor even the opportunity to exercise his discretion. So Myers is not analogous to the present case. Your Honors, certainly the district court was correct in ruling in favor of the defendants in this case based upon standing, but also I'd like to briefly touch upon immunity. And yes, absolute immunity is something completely different than the issue of standing. There is no standing, period, end of story. But of course this court can uphold the district court on any grounds that it deems fit. And I just would like to point out that the entire core of problems that the appellants have with the prosecutors in this case, they flow from the prosecutor's refusal, or I should say, they flow from the charging decision. Prosecutors, in making charging decisions, that is at the very core of their prosecutorial function. That is beyond dispute. And in this case, there actually was a charge. A charge was filed against Mr. Belt, but then about 6 months later, it was dismissed. But prosecutors still are entitled to absolute immunity for decisions to prosecute, for decisions not to prosecute, or for decisions just to stop a prosecution after it had started. And this is true. This immunity is there, and this is true even in the face of a constitutional violation. In Imbler, the main case on prosecutorial immunity, in that case, a criminal defendant alleged that a prosecutor violated his constitutional due process rights by, among other things, withholding evidence that he should have turned over under Brady. But the court still gave that prosecutor absolute immunity. It doesn't matter if there is a constitutional violation underlying it. This court, in the case of White versus Bloom, held that even though the criminal defendant was making an equal protection allegation, still the prosecutor was entitled to that absolute immunity. And in closing, very quickly, prosecutors are state employees. They are not county employees. They do not answer to the county. They do not supervise the county, nor does the county supervise them. Support for this is set forth on appellee's brief, page 4, note 1, and there is nothing in the record to the contrary. Your Honors, thank you very much for your attention, and if there are no questions, I will give the floor to Mr. Owens, but we, the appellees Tabor and Shue, respectfully request that this court uphold the district court's decision.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Owens, you may proceed. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jason Owens. I represent the separate appellee, Sebastian County. The issue in this case at this point is the standing issue. It's the issue on which Judge Dawson decided the case in favor of the appellees. And the issue within the issue is whether the plaintiff alleges sufficient injury to confer standing. In counsel's remarks for the appellant, counsel compared this case to the selective prosecution and selective enforcement or selective protection cases that they cited in the briefing. And he said that in this case, like those cases, that his client or clients, quote, didn't get the same kind of justice, end quote, as allegedly favored victims. This mirrors the language in the plaintiff appellant's complaint in the district court when they described their injury in paragraph 78 as a, quote, loss of justice. Your Honors, I would submit that there is simply no constitutional right to justice in the abstract, and that's why there's no standing in this case. The appellant tries to muddy the waters on this point by, number one, not mentioning standing. Standing was barely mentioned in counsel's arguments and in much of the briefing as well, but he tries to muddy the waters by talking interchangeably about two very different kinds of cases that are generally referred to as selective prosecution cases on the one hand and selective enforcement or protection cases on the other hand. All of these selective prosecution cases cited in this matter were pursued by criminal defendants, and that includes Myers' case, which is certainly the closest call on the issue before the court. Counsel said that while the Myers plaintiff was a criminal defendant, that this wasn't what his claim was about. Regardless, it's where he derived his standing. In fact, that's evidenced by the fact that he sought damages in that case for the legal fees that he'd spent on his defense as a criminal defendant. There's simply no doubt that the Myers plaintiff got his standing from being a criminal defendant below. Selective enforcement cases, or more appropriately, selective protection cases, are a little bit different in terms of standing, because in those cases, the plaintiff derives standing from an injury suffered by private conduct occasioned by the affirmative action of government actors. In other words, I think the best case that I read on this was this court's decision in the Freeman versus Ferguson case, which came shortly after the DeShaney decision in the Supreme Court. DeShaney, of course, said that random criminal that the government has no duty to protect citizens from random criminal conduct. Ultimately, it would be an impossible duty to bear. And so the DeShaney court cut it off completely and said that the government has no duty to protect citizens from private criminal conduct. However, Freeman said that because DeShaney at least analyzed the potential for liability under Section 1983 in non-custodial settings, essentially DeShaney said that in order for a protection duty to arise, there must be some special relationship between the government and the citizen. Normally, that relationship is a custodial relationship when they're in jail or otherwise in the custody of the government. But Freeman says that sometimes that special, and I think this has been borne out in the case law since then, that this relationship can exist in a non-custodial setting where there is a special relationship, where the government, through affirmative action, exposes the citizen to a higher risk of harm than would otherwise have been occasioned by just the random nature of criminal conduct. In the Freeman case in particular, the police chief told his officers, allegedly, again, that one was at the motion to dismiss stage again, as I recall, but allegedly told his officers not to check the reported criminal conduct of one of the police chief's friends. In other words, said, stay away from Bud, I believe his name was. That didn't happen in this case. There was simply no injury by private conduct, no injury by prosecution, and for those reasons, there's no standing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lesher.
Thank you. The prosecutors in the county really haven't offered any new arguments in oral argument. They didn't offer in their briefs. Just very quickly, the Linda R.S. case, and this is very important, the Linda R.S. case never states in its holding anywhere that a victim does not have standing to pursue an equal protection claim against a prosecutor or any other law enforcement officer. In fact, the Linda R.S. case specifically says that that case was not, could not be a case involving equal protection claims against a prosecutor because the statute under which the plaintiff was seeking protection didn't apply to her circumstances. She perhaps could have challenged the statute, but that was not the claim she made. So there was no claim of prosecutorial discrimination that the court made a decision on in Linda R.S. Again, we don't dispute that you don't have a right to enforce a specific prosecution or specific law enforcement, but that's not what this case is about. Now, as for the defendant saying there was no injury in this case, well, look at cases like Northeastern Florida Chapter of the Associated General Contractors of America. I'm sorry, it's a long title. But that, Turner v. Fauci, I'm just going to quote a line from the first case. The injury, in fact, in an equal protection case, I'm skipping a few words, is the denial of equal treatment. No injury? That's the injury. When you're a victim of discriminatory procedures by law enforcement officials, that's the injury. To say the injury came about because of the assailant is just to confuse the issue. It's sophistry. That's not the nature of the injury alleged here. And the same thing again is said in the case of Macias. The district court in Macias, which was reversed by the appellate by the Ninth Circuit, did say that the reason there's no injury here is that the police didn't necessarily prevent this woman from being killed by the man who was stalking her. Said the Ninth Circuit, that's not the injury. The injury was the discriminatory policy. Now, I think, you know, based on the precedents that we've presented at this point, I think it's reasonably clear which side here is actually presenting equal protection law the way it is and which side is trying to change it. What is really happening is that the prosecutors in this case are asking this court to issue a new precedent in equal protection law that says prosecutors may discriminate with impunity. They may discriminate against any class of crime victims, and they may do it overtly. And if that is granted, if that precedent is granted, not only does it contradict all the precedents that we have on cases involving crime victims suing law enforcement officials under the Equal Protection Clause, it essentially creates an exception that sinks the right. Because now you're going to say in every one of those cases what we really meant was you have a right to a criminal charge, a criminal investigation, an arrest, but not prosecution. Not the process that completes that law enforcement process and results in conviction and punishment. If that's the case, where's the right to equal protection of law enforcement? I'm sorry, I see my time is up. I urge this court to reverse the district court below and keep equal protection law where it is.
Very well. The case is submitted. We will take it under consideration.